Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Well, the big news this week is that Democrats in the House and the Senate have achieved a milestone victory with the passage of the American Rescue Act, which passed the Senate on Tuesday with zero Republican support. Now, let's look at the history here. Back in March of 2020, Democrats, not Republicans, proposed a relief bill. That bill included the vitally important extension of eligibility to receive unemployment benefits for those of us who are self-employed, those of us who are independent contractors, performing artists, and itinerant workers, also known as gig workers or freelancers. I myself, as you know, am a self-employed artist. I make my living selling my work at art shows and music festivals and Renaissance festivals. My first ever show, the one that launched my career, in fact, was our own community festival here in Columbus. I was at the Arizona Renaissance Festival, which runs for 8 weeks, when the national shutdown began, and we lost the last 2 weeks of the festival. And there hasn't been a retail event where I could sell since. Indeed, the first opportunity for me to return to a festival safely might not be until July of this year. The first stimulus bill also included a federal supplement for those weekly unemployment benefits of $600 for a couple of months. For me, this was great. I had nearly as much income as I would have been making had the shows and festivals continued. I didn't really think the pandemic would last as long as it has, so I invested much of that money in materials. And I've been producing at a leisurely pace in my studio for the whole ensuing year, and gardening and doing unpaid radio work, etc. But just as quickly as those $600 a week unemployment benefits ran out, my meager savings began to dwindle. Democrats had proposed a second stimulus bill with a lot of carve-outs for essential social programs to help the people less privileged than I am from sinking into abject poverty. The Republicans, however, objected and stalled, and this was back in May of last year. Trump wanted to include some poison pills in the Republican version of the relief bill, more tax cuts for the rich, prosecutorial immunity for employers who subject their workers to unsafe working conditions that lead to employees getting infected with COVID, like the three bars in the Short North or so that would have rallied for that clause, I'm sure. And a little rider that eliminated the payroll tax funds for Social Security. Despite the occasional promise not to cut that, there it was, the plan to gut it almost entirely. Democrats dutifully said no, and a months-long stalemate ensued. It was around the time that the Republican strategists and their media allies started promoting a number of myths and half-truths to poison the population against the Democrats' proposals. One of these was that the bill included massive amounts of foreign aid unrelated to the pandemic. Another was that it funded various arts programs. Now, this is complicated by the fact that due to the Republican foot-dragging, the relief bill ended up getting attached to an annual omnibus spending bill that did have foreign aid obligations and contractual funding for some arts organizations like the Kennedy Center. This enabled armchair naysayers to criticize the entire relief bill as pork and nepotism, the Democrats' way of appealing to their base at the taxpayers' expense. Never mind that the Democratic base consists primarily of taxpayers who pay disproportionately more than the Republican base, yet who continually vote to support public services. Democrats, meanwhile, despite intense negotiations and bipartisan committees and panels and compromises of 50, 60, or even 70% on some things, were unable to wrangle a majority or even a unanimous party line unity, with Senators Manchin of West Virginia and Sinema of Arizona repeatedly breaking ranks. So the bill was stripped of the spending bill and replaced with a small menu of stopgap measures. Unemployment was extended for 11 weeks, the eviction moratorium was extended for a month, the pandemic, which had already been obscenely mismanaged and had raged out of control, fulfilling some of the worst predictions of public health experts, states were deprived of any kind of guidance from the federal government, and even the leadership of the CDC was muzzled and pressured to downplay scientific information regarding any pandemic response. The anti-mask, anti-vaccination, anti-immigrant hordes were emboldened as the states were left to adopt mask mandates and quarantines on their own discretion. Many states with Republican administrations, like Ohio, issued loose and barely enforced guidelines that were at times confusing and nearly always toothless. The reopening of public schools was one of the few exceptions. By now, folks who had been unemployed for the better part of a year were getting pretty desperate, and there were many who were unemployed who, for a variety of reasons, don't even qualify at all. The lines at food pantries and food giveaways stretched for blocks or hours. Fortunately, in the midst of all of this, we had an election, and it was a highly impressive one in terms of its efficiency and accuracy. Republicans, who lost the White House and the Senate, balked that there had been fraud, enough fraud nationwide to eclipse Biden's lead of close to 8 million votes. No credible evidence has been presented to date demonstrating such massive fraud, or even any widespread fraud to any degree. Yet, low-information consumers of cynical propaganda and devotees of the former chief executive carried that big lie like a sacred ember, and on January 6th, after several weeks of active planning by white supremacists, Republican state attorney generals, and the former chief's own staff and allies, the defenders of the new Confederacy, of dunces, staged an attempted coup at the Capitol building on January 6th. Fortunately, that failed, and now lives as an anchor that the Republican Party will forever tow and be known by. On day one of the Biden administration, then, a flurry of monumental executive orders were issued to turn the tide, including rejoining the World Health Organization. Work began immediately also on a new COVID relief bill. The new bill's authors had hoped to get at least some Republican support and offered a few compromises, trimming an item here and there. But it was opposition from within their own party, again from Sinema and Manchin and also from six others, to the proposal to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour that proved to be the sticking point. When the party leaders agreed to drop that, all the Democrats got on board, and the bill passed with all 50 Democrats in support, and it was opposed by 49 of the 50 Republicans, with the 50th one simply not voting. So, what's in the bill? Republicans say, again, that it's all pork for Democratic pet projects. It does have a very small carve-out of foreign aid that's specifically COVID-related, but the Republicans are claiming that only 9% is devoted to fighting the pandemic. That, of course, is simply not true. The bill is a standalone, not attached to anything else, and I won't try to list everything here, but here are some of the major highlights. The bill extends unemployment, including the $300 a week federal supplements, through September. It will yield a one-time $1,400 payment to anyone earning less than $75,000 a year. It extends and increases the child tax credit, a measure which proponents say will cut child poverty rates in the U.S. in half. By the way, did you know that the child poverty here in the United States is higher than the next 35 industrialized nations in the world? A recent study by UNICEF showed that the U.S. ranked 36th in a list of 39 nations in which child poverty was measured, and these are the nations with the highest wealth or highest gross national product. We have a greater percentage of children in poverty than Mexico or Chile or Greece or Hungary or Poland and Lithuania, just to mention a few. Anyway, according to the backers of this bill, this will fix that for now. The bill has over $7 billion for new business loans, new small business loans, that is, and a special carve-out for restaurants. $128 billion goes to schools to increase staffing, make infrastructure improvements related to sanitation, like air filtration, etc. The bill makes millions available for federally funded child care programs and home energy assistance, billions rather. Nearly $40 billion goes toward elder care with senior nutrition, and an even larger amount goes to nutrition assistance for low-income folks. Nearly $60 billion goes to addressing COVID directly, and there's a large chunk for housing assistance. There's even a clause that protects workers' pensions, a big victory for unions and retirees. And there's a pretty sizable package of aid for Native Americans, who are some of the most severely affected populations in the U.S. Here's a clip from a report from the Muskogee Radio Weekly radio program from the Muskogee Nation, now located in Oklahoma.
The American Rescue Plan Act of 2021 has passed the United States Senate and is expected to be passed again by the United States House of Representatives along a party-line vote on March 10th. What support can Native American tribes expect in this latest stimulus bill? The Bureau of Indian Education will receive $850 million to be allocated by the Secretary of the Interior within 30 days of the bill's passing. These funds will be made available to Bureau-funded schools as well as tribal colleges or universities. The bill also adds $10 million to the Native American Programs Act of 1974 and adds language to the act to provide emergency grants for Native American language preservation and maintenance. Indian health funding is appropriated $6 billion, which is broken down into the following disbursements: $2 billion for lost reimbursements, $500 million for the provision of additional health care services provided through the purchased referred care program, $140 million for information technology, telehealth infrastructure, and Indian health electronic record systems, $84 million for maintaining operations of the Urban Indian Health Program, $600 million for vaccine planning, administration, and tracking, $1.5 billion to detect, diagnose, trace, and monitor COVID-19 infections, $240 million to establish, expand, and sustain a public health workforce, $420 million for expenses related to mental and behavioral health prevention and treatment services, $600 million for lease, purchase, construction, alteration, renovation, or equipping of health facilities, $10 million for potable water delivery. The bill also includes funding for Native American HUD programs, such as $455 million for Native American housing block grants, $280 million for Indian community development block grants. In addition, funding is made available to tribal governments in the following amounts: $100 million for tribal housing improvement, $772 million for tribal government services, public safety and justice, social services, child welfare assistance, and other related expenses, $20 million to provide and deliver potable water. Both Senator James Lankford and Senator Jim Inhofe voted no when the bill passed through the U.S. Senate. Due to amendments added in the Senate, the bill must pass through the House again, and the Oklahoma House delegation, who are all Republicans, are expected to vote against it.
So the bill, without a single Republican in Congress supporting it, now goes into effect. You will be getting your $1,400 check. You will see vaccines becoming more available. You will be able to have more confidence that as schools reopen, they'll do so safely. And you probably will be able to count on more of your favorite eateries still being there as the pandemic subsides, all thanks to this bill. And the $15 an hour minimum wage push isn't going away. Indeed, Senate and congressional leaders and President Biden have vowed to push for it and to bring it up again and again until it passes, either with some crossover support from Republicans or by other means. Will Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who campaigned on raising the minimum wage as recently as 2014, finally relent? Here's Crystal Ball speaking to that point.
All right, Crystal, what's on your radar?
Well, a few big things happened over the weekend. We got a big new relief bill, and we have a new contender for worst person in D.C., Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. So, as you may know by now, Biden and Democratic leadership, they use the non-binding advice of the Senate parliamentarian as an excuse to block a minimum wage hike. Progressives were pissed, but they had kind of a weak response. Rather than threatening to torpedo the bill over the issue the way that the right wing of the party frequently does, Senator Sanders decided instead to force a vote on the minimum wage hike. He knew that it wouldn't pass, but at least getting the enemies of the working class on the record would be useful. And in fact, it did turn out to be quite revealing. 8 Democratic senators joined every single Republican in voting against a living wage. Here they are, along with their net worth. Just a bunch of millionaires screwing over the poor. In other words, a typical day in America. Few things of note here. First of all, both of the senators from Delaware voted against the increase. Notably, Chris Coons, who's considered to be Biden's voice in the Senate, voted against it. This just confirms that Biden did not lift one single finger to try to get a $15 minimum wage through. Next, some credit to some of the new senators from swing states who did vote for the increase, exposing the lie that this is any sort of electoral liability. In fact, voting against a minimum wage hike is the real electoral liability. John Ossoff, Dr. Warnock, they both voted for $15. And notably, Mark Kelly, junior senator of Arizona, who's up for re-election, he voted for it. Unfortunately, the senior senator from Arizona, Kyrsten Sinema, did not. Now, in theory, Sinema's vote against the minimum wage was only as awful as the votes against it from 57 other senators. But she went above and beyond to display her utter contempt for the working class and, well, every other decent person in this country. Just take a look at this. So, you can see, she walks in, she waves at Mitch McConnell, she does her little thumbs down, her little cutesy curtsy there, turns on her heel, and struts off the screen. Apparently, she also brought cake to the floor, practically begging for Marie Antoinette comparisons here. Yes, while we were distracted by how terrible Joe Manchin is, we forgot how awful Sinema is as well. She opposes getting rid of the filibuster, too, just in case you were wondering if she might have some redeeming qualities. But don't worry. If you found her obnoxious display to be hideous and contemptible, Sinema and her media defenders have got some news for you. The problem isn't her middle finger in the face of working Americans. It's that you're sexist for pointing it out. That's right. Her office's response to the outrage sparked by Sinema's vote and contemptful display was, quote, commentary about a female senator's body language, clothing, or physical demeanor does not belong in a serious media outlet. Give me a damn break. We are not talking about your clothes or your body language. We're talking about you gleefully keeping millions of workers in poverty. By the way, you want to talk about sexism? You know who would disproportionately benefit from a minimum wage hike? Women, and especially women of color. Crying sexism, though, is apparently the only thing they could come up with here. Here's former Ted Cruz aide Amanda Carpenter latching onto the exact same talking point in her defense of poverty wages.
I think the hubbub over that was frankly ridiculous. I understand there's a lot of progressives who are upset she wasn't supporting the minimum wage hike. Frankly, that had no business in a spending bill. Raising the federal minimum wage is essentially a mandate for the states. It doesn't have to do with federal spending in that regard. And I don't understand. It is a common way of voting to do thumbs up and thumbs down. That's what she did. And so I think it's a little sexist, the treatment that she got. I don't know if it's because of the outfit she wore. I don't know if it's because she bent her knees a little bit. But she voted, and she voted how she saw fit.
That's right. Sinema is standing up for the right of bi women to be just as monstrous as any cis white man. Slay queen? What really sucks is that Sinema used to actually have good politics, or at least she pretended to. She was a spokesperson for the Arizona Green Party. She was a social worker. She came into Arizona politics championing progressive issues and, yes, fighting for a minimum wage increase. Here she is in 2014 lamenting how low the minimum wage was. Of course, since that time, the wage has remained at $7.25 and inflation has continued to climb. Her original foray into politics, like mine and millions of others, was in opposition to the Iraq War. Sinema was a formidable peace activist, organizing anti-war rallies, stating her opposition to war actually in all forms. But even on this issue that was so core to her developing political identity, she's just become another lapdog for the military-industrial complex, completely indistinguishable from every other standard-issue hawk in the Democratic or Republican parties on that. In Washington, she apparently decided to let her identity stand in for any sort of progressive policy commitments. It's all so hollow and transparent. Does it make you feel better that it's a queer woman with eccentric fashion taste who's keeping you at starvation wages? Or for that fact, that the first black woman vice president was there to serve in the historic role of not overruling the Senate parliamentarian on the fight for 15. The only good news is that I honestly don't believe there's a single regular person who buys any of this crap. Only people who are either completely disingenuous or who have had their brains turned into curdled DC goo ever repeat this garbage. Crying sexism with a straight face in order to defend the people who do the most to ultimately hurt women. And that's the key point here.
Yeah.
That really exposes the whole thing. Complaining about sexism for criticizing her vote here, the minimum wage would do so much to lift millions of women out of poverty. But they try to use this identity play. I mean, I just think that it completely fell flat, and they've they've gone to this particular trick so many times that I think everybody just sees through.
It's amazing how they all lean towards this. Same thing. Remember we were talking about Elaine Chao and her, you know, Chinese
corruption
reveal? Yes. She's like, well, this is an attack on the first Asian American cabinet. I'm like, screw you. All right? You're looking at this. We don't want to hear this. And yeah, look, defend it on the merits. If you think that was a politically defensible position to make on behalf of your state, go ahead. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a reason Mark Kelly voted for it and she didn't. And I think that that is particularly revealing. Their whole model of politics is crazy. I mean, we'll talk about this later in the show. Jim Justice, the Republican governor, is bashing Joe Manchin for revising down what West Virginia needs. Maybe because he actually knows how to get elected. And I'm not saying Manchin would neither. In terms of the cross-aisle stuff that would actually get these people in trouble, what is it? If Kristen Sinema voted for, like, a third trimester abortion, yeah, I think she'd be in trouble. Same with Joe Manchin. Or the Equality Act, and there's a reason that one's never, ever coming to the Senate floor. Because they don't want to vote for it. That's the type of thing that actually would get them in trouble. I just don't believe. I see zero evidence in the crosstabs that they would pay any price for having a larger stimulus bill or for a $15 minimum wage.
Yeah.
I just don't see it.
But
it,
you come to this town and you end up with D.C. brain worms and you end up with a whole bunch of corporate cash and Chamber of Commerce money and all of that. And that's what happened to Sinema. I mean, she's the perfect example of, like, she used to have great politics.
Yeah,
I mean, really, like she did. She was
like a Green Party. That's what Martha McSally was bombing her with.
Absolutely. Yeah. She was pretty radical, honestly. And she's working with, she had a radio she's talking about, we'll work with anybody, anarchist, socialist, communist, we don't care, in the anti-war effort. She was really out front on this. And then you come here, you take all this corporate campaign cash, you hang out with Mitch McConnell, apparently she's there, like, patting him on the back. And you end up taking votes like this and feeling, like, so proud of doing it that you make this whole display for everyone to see. It's such a case in point of exactly what happens to people when they come to D.C. Now, I do think, on the hopeful side, the fact that both of the senators in Georgia and Mark Kelly, who, again, is up for re-election, that they voted for it, I think it shows you that maybe they're starting to shake off this old way of thinking, because that's
The new generation.
Yeah, that's what Manchin and Sinema, they're buying into this old, like, Bill Clinton, DLC way of thinking, where it's like, we always got to screw over our base. Whatever, like, people actually want, we got to be against it to show how conservative we are, to show how moderate we are. I think that there's a real movement against that. And maybe, just maybe, there's starting to be an understanding that, yeah, on the cultural issues, if you're in a conservative state, especially depending, like, a state like West Virginia, you got to be careful there because you are going to be dramatically at odds. But Manchin, look, $15 minimum wage is popular.
Yes.
These programs are
popular. His own governor is bashing.
Popular.
Yeah.
Right? The relief bill, popular.
Yeah.
And I also think that the other thing that's really revealing is, like, once again, Manchin was completely willing to walk away from this thing to get what he wanted.
He did. He held the floor up for 4 hours.
There was a whole dramatic scene over the weekend where they weren't sure. It was really in limbo. They were not sure that they were ultimately going to get Manchin's vote. And he never gets punished or criticized. Can you imagine if Bernie had actually gone to the mat and been like, no, I'm not voting for it unless you put the $15 minimum wage in. He would have been the biggest villain that had ever walked into this town. But with Manchin, they're just like, no, that's just Joe. That's what he does.
And the media deflects for him, too. I've seen, like, Chris Hayes and them being like, Joe Manchin, well, I've never been elected in R plus 40 state. I'm like, yes, you can recognize that. But you can also say, when the Republican governor is criticizing him, something is going on here.
Yeah.
When the other colleague, you know, Mark Kelly votes for it and the other doesn't, something is going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like I said, if he voted for a third trimester abortion, I think he'd be dead. But I do not think there are a lot of people in West Virginia who are going to punish him for something like this. So it's just their entire political, like, valence is just completely wrong. And it's based on a media Chamber of Commerce creation about what it means to be centrist, which is just false from their own states.
That political strategy, ideology, et cetera, is what turned West Virginia into an R plus 40 state.
It's true.
That's a really recent development that came directly out of the Bill Clinton DLC way of doing politics. That's exactly why you lost West Virginia and why it's so hard to get anyone elected there from the Democratic Party. But they don't really want to notice that part, do they?
It's okay.
Next on Rising, Colin O'Hara and Jonathan Easley. They're going to join us for Team Rising. That is next.
So while we can all breathe a sigh of conditional relief now that this big relief bill has passed, one person who is anything but relieved is political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, who has now contracted COVID in prison. This is on top of heart and liver diseases that he's developed while incarcerated for a murder that he and his supporters insist he did not commit. We'll hear next from a radio show produced by one of our Pacific affiliates in an edition posted this week dealing with Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is an excerpt from The People's War, which originates from Black Power Radio based in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Huru, welcome to The People's War Radio Show. I'm Dr. Matsumela Odom.
And I'm Uwambi Tungu. Uhuru means freedom in Swahili, and freedom is on our minds 24/7.
Today we're going to talk about the campaign to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia Abu-Jamal is an African political prisoner who has been behind bars in Pennsylvania for 39 years. He was framed for the 1981 murder of a Philadelphia police officer. This was part of an ongoing counterinsurgency that military defeated the Black Revolution of the 60s. To discuss this with us today, we have Mike Africa Jr. of the MOVE organization.
Mike Africa Jr. is an activist and the host of the podcast On a MOVE with Mike Africa Jr. He is the focus of the HBO original documentary 40 Years a Prisoner. He is a stage performer, keynote speaker, and a hip-hop artist. Mike Jr. is also the son of Debbie and Mike Africa, two members of the MOVE 9 who were convicted in the murder of a Philadelphia cop during the 1978 police assault and burning of the MOVE house in West Philly.
Uhuru, Mike, thank you for coming on the People's War Radio Show. Last Wednesday, there was a press conference calling for an end to the inhumane treatment of ill and elderly prisoners in Pennsylvania and demanding the immediate release of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Can you give our listeners an understanding of who Mumia is?
Uhuru, on the MOVE. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, first of all. I do appreciate the time to get a chance to talk to the people a little bit and explain to folks who Mumia is and where he is in his life at this point. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a political prisoner, first off, and he has been in prison, like you said, since 1981. Mumia is a journalist. He's a husband, he's a father, he's a grandfather, and a great-grandfather. He was accused of killing a cop in 1981. The reason he's in prison, though, has nothing to do with a dead cop. The reason Mumia is in prison is because he speaks the truth against the injustices in the system. When MOVE was going through the things that we were going through with the police and the officials in the city of Philadelphia, Mumia was a journalist that was speaking out about the experiences, and he would tell the truth about what was going on. And as a result, he became a target. And being a target in this country, especially when the person that's targeting you is a racist like Frank Rizzo, they see to it that they try to see to it that they eliminate you. And when they couldn't kill him, they put him in prison. And that was nearly 40 years ago. And today he remains in prison.
Yeah. You know, Mumia really was targeted by Frank Rizzo because of his defense of the MOVE organization. You know, he was the president of the Association of Black Journalists. And like, as you know, it has really continued that work behind bars. So from behind prison walls, Mumia Abu-Jamal has continued to speak out, delivering regular commentaries over the phone for distribution by independent media outlets. Here's one of them. Produced in December 2008, following the selection of U.S. President Barack Obama.
False freedom. There's a certain sense in the minds of millions in the aftermath of the U.S. presidential election that we've reached a promised land. The imagery and oratory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is invoked to suggest that his dream, as articulated in his epic I Have a Dream speech, has been realized. There's a deep sense that freedom is here, as we all live in a post-racial America. Or do we? To be sure, we're all on the brink of history, for this has never happened before. But there was a time, quite a while ago, that similar feelings swept the nation, and especially black hearts, that a new day was breaking, and the old ways had fallen away, when freedom was as real as rain. I speak of the Reconstruction era, when the nation extended civil rights to millions of black men, not to women, notably, and scores of black people took office in state and federal legislatures and began a wave of progressive legislation to better the abominable living conditions of millions, black and white alike. But Reconstruction was short-lived due to the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, the betrayal of black freedmen by the federal government, and the campaign of white terrorism against black people and Republicans, which converged to reassert white supremacy. What this history revealed is that freedom can be ephemeral. It matters not what is written in constitutions, nor the rhetoric or promises of politicians. It matters what people fight for. It matters what social movements struggle for. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal's 2008 message following the selection of President Barack Obama. Like you said, his incarceration has nothing to do with what he's accused of. It has to do with the fact that he stood up against in defensive move. He stood up against the terror of the colonial and neocolonial government through which Africans endured.
Mike, you said that Mumia was arrested and convicted, you know, for basically a false conviction of, you know, they say he killed a cop. We know initially he was sentenced to death and now he's serving life in a life sentence. How did that happen?
The man of the people. A lot of people got involved to try to support Mumia during his case, within his case and during his trials. And with a lot of legal maneuvers, Mumia's attorneys found a way to force the system to take back the death penalty and give him life in prison as an alternative. They found it to be unconstitutional to put him in, to keep him in prison on death row. And therefore they put him on life without parole. That happened sometime in like 2000. What was that? 2008 or nine or something. It's been a while. But the fact that he's still in prison and facing the type of ailments that he has, life in prison, life without parole is nothing more than slow death row. Now, I don't really consider his life to be unthreatened now just because they took him off of death row status and put him on life without parole status. This is slow death row. Life without parole is slow death row because the same punishment, the same torture that the death row inmates endure, the life without parole inmates endure the same things. And many people behind the walls in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania prisons are facing the same exact thing. Mumia is suffering from hepatitis C. He's suffering from eczema, extreme eczema. He's suffering from COVID-19, and he's also suffering from heart disease. And at this point, we're not sure, you know, how long he can last with all of these different ailments without the proper care. You know, when you're relying on the DOC to take care of you, the Department of Correction to take care of you, you can't really expect them to do the type of job that would give you true healing. So we're trying to urge folks to get involved to support his release so that he can get treatment from a good source of medical attention.
Really appreciate that. You are listening to the People's War Radio Show, produced by WBPU Black Power 96.3 FM, in St. Petersburg, Florida. Our guest today is Mike Africa Jr.
On August 9th, 1978, just 3 years before Mumia's arrest, hundreds of Philadelphia cops, under the direction of then-mayor and notorious anti-black thug Frank Rizzo, attacked one of the MOVE organization's houses and arrested nine of their members for the murder of one police officer. Mumia was one of the few journalists, as we noted, that came to the defense of the MOVE organization and spoke out against the attacks. Your mother, Debbie Africa, was 8 months pregnant with you when the police attacked the MOVE house in 1978. Both she and your father, Mike Africa Sr., survived the attack and were framed for the murder of the cop who died in the assault. Can you tell us about MOVE and the constant attacks that you all have endured by the state over the years?
Well, first, let me just make a correction. It wasn't August 9th, 1978. It was August 8th, 1978. To talk about the assaults, you know, the assaults on MOVE throughout the entire existence of the organization have been much like the assaults that you've seen on George Floyd and on Breonna Taylor and on Ahmaud Arbery and on Trayvon Martin and on other countless other members of the Black community. MOVE has been assaulted by the police and assaulted by the system ever since MOVE, but even before MOVE. The MOVE organization is not a unique organization in the sense of suffering from police attacks or official brutality from these people. MOVE has joined in with other organizations that's been involved in protesting against these things. And therefore, the attacks have come harder because John Africa, who is the founder of the organization, has a certain level of wisdom that is very persuasive and powerful, much like a lot of other people, too. But when you have concentrated wisdom, you're much more of a concentrated target. But some of the attacks that we've experienced, listen, MOVE women have been beaten into miscarriage by police. MOVE babies have been killed by police. The police dropped the bomb on our house May 13th, 1985, and killed 11 of our family members, including 5 kids. You know, we've endured a lot. They put my parents in prison and gave them a 100-year jail sentence for a crime that 40 years later, the government apologized for. It's incredible. It's incredible that these things happen. It's incredible that these things are allowed to happen. It's incredible that they're allowed to happen by the public. It's also incredible that they're allowed to happen by the government. But it's important for us to know that the government don't care. They don't care about us. And that sounds like a obvious statement. But if you examine it a little closer, a little deeper, you look at the examples that proves that point. Right now, Derek Chauvin, the cop that killed George Floyd, kneeled on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, premeditated murder. He's on trial. If anybody in this country has ever seen a cop on trial, we already know how that trial is going to end. Meanwhile, you got people like Mumi Abu-Jamal, who's in prison for a questionable, very questionable case. And if the state has it their way, he'll die in prison. There's something wrong with that. There's a level of inequality that is unmatched in this country by anywhere else in the entire world. The United States has over 2.7 million people in prison. Disproportionately, the majority of those people are Black. Meanwhile, in everywhere, every other country in the world, it's a far less conviction rating, far less prison time. But the government makes so much money off of keeping people in prison. They need to keep people in prison to make money. That's their job. That's an industry. It's no different than the industry that makes clothes. They're making money off of the exploitation of life. And MOVE has spoken out about this throughout the history of the organization. And we've been a target. And every type of assault that you can think of has been waged against us.
Oh, thanks for that.
Mike, I wanted to say congratulations on the recent release of 40 Years a Prisoner, the HBO original documentary detailing your struggle to get your parents and the MOVE 9 released from prison. Can you talk about that?
Sure. What do you want to know?
I know that the documentary released right around the time of the police murder of Walter Wallace. And there was a screening actually in the middle of the protests, and some of the comrades out there in Philadelphia attended the screening. So, you know, sometimes when you look at some of the films, they tend to just be, you know, just a chronicle of the past, you know, which sometimes allow for people to think, oh, well, stuff was bad in the past, but clearly that's not the point of the documentary. That's not the point of the cultural work that you have produced around the stuff, right? It's about, so, you know, I really appreciate the way through which in your interview, and like you said, sort of connecting the you know, the repression that the MOVE organization has experienced to this, you know, continued freedom struggle of African people and stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure. Getting this information out on big screens on major platforms such as HBO, it's important for this information to land in spaces like that, because that's a mainstream, and you get more eyes on it. You get more people who didn't know knowing. And the more people know, the more able you are to gain some traction on getting support. The truth, there's a saying that the truth shall set you free. Well, that's real. That's why the government spends so much time making sure that they tell people lies. You know, the truth shall set you free. That's why they force people into these schools so that they can teach these children lies. The truth shall set you free. That's why the government spends so much time with these television shows pushing out their propaganda and telling these lies. The more people know why Derek Chauvin killed George Floyd, the more outraged people will be, the less likely they will be to accept or tolerate it. The more people know about what happened to my family and that I'm not the only person that this happened to, and I'm certainly not the only person that this will have happened to. If you don't do something about what's happening now, then you're going to have more situations like this. So I'm pleased that the documentary got to 40 years of prison and made it to HBO. And I'm also pleased about Judas and the Black Messiah making it to theaters and winning awards and all of that, because the more people know, the less the government can hide, you know, and they need to hide to continue to do what they're doing. So we need to expose and bring this stuff out into the forefront so that people can see it, so that we can resist it.
Uhura Unite, thanks for that. You are listening to the People's War Radio Show, produced by WBPU, Black Power 96.3 FM in St. Petersburg, Florida. Our guest today is Mike Africa.
Uhuru, you said earlier that Mumia Abu-Jamal's life sentence without parole is a slow death sentence. And we know that he spent most of his time in solitary confinement and has been under constant attack by the state. Can you tell us anything else about the conditions that he's faced?
What do you mean that he's faced, like throughout over the years, or like?
That he's been facing over the years. Earlier, you got into some of the health conditions that he's faced, and I was just wanted to see if there's more you could tell us about what he's been experiencing behind bars.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of details that people don't know. You know, you don't know what people go through when they're in prison unless they tell you. But there, you know, when you watch the movies, prison movies, and people being strip searched and beaten by guards and raped by guards and separated from their families, locked in cages for 23 hours a day. And when I say a cage, I'm talking about if you're a 6-foot man, you can touch both walls just by spreading your arms out. Restricted from contact with your family, you know, watching your head on a swivel, watching your back throughout the time you're there, just because you don't know who is who. You know, you got so many men, thousands of men, a couple thousand men, you know, with their own issues, their own problems, guards coming to work, taking out frustrations on people with nightsticks, with mace, with charges. I did an interview with a brother who just got out of prison recently himself after 30 years. And he talked to me about how, you know, when they strip you down and make you take off all your clothes and they spray that, they throw that white powder on you. They do that to you while your hands are touching, both hands touching a wall. And the reason your hands both have to touch the wall is just in case you might try or want to retaliate against one of the guards. So they make you put both hands on the wall. And if one of your hands come off, whether it's by accident or not, even if it comes off for a split second, the moment that it doesn't make contact with the wall, the guards have the right to attack you and attack you with justification, quote unquote justification, because you attempted to assault them because one of your hands came off the wall when they told you to put your hands on the wall. You know, and you have, at that point, you're in danger of getting a write-up or being assaulted and beaten and pinned to the ground with your neck under the heavy foot, the heavy steel-toed boot of a prison guard. This is the type of stuff that people in prison go through every single day. And in the case of a person like Mumia, who's been in prison nearly four decades, they've seen this and they've experienced this. It's a horrible thing to have to live under the rules, the oppression of a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, or brown-eyed person that hates you just because you're black, or just because you're an inmate, or just because they can, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for that. Really, really keeping it real and laying out the contradictions. Bumia Abu-Jamal is perhaps the most talked about political prisoner with international support.
In November 2020, Colin Kaepernick made this public statement in support of the campaign to free Mumia.
I was invited to speak on behalf of Mumia. One of the first things that came to mind was how long he's been in prison. How many years of his life have been stolen away from him, his community, and his loved ones. He's been incarcerated for 38 years. Mumia has been in prison longer than I've been alive. When I first spoke with Mumia on the phone, I did very little talking. I just listened. Hearing him speak was a reminder of why we must continue to fight. Earlier this year, the United Nations Human Rights Office of the High Commissioner issued a statement noting that prolonged solitary confinement, the precise type often used in the United States, amounts to psychological torture. Mumia Abu-Jamal has spent roughly 30 out of his 38 years in solitary confinement. In his book, Live from Death Row, Mumia wrote that prison is a second-by-second assault on the soul, a day-to-day degradation of the self, an oppressive steel and brick umbrella that transforms seconds into hours and hours into days. He has had to endure this second-by-second assault on his soul for 38 years. He had no record before he was arrested and framed for the death of a Philadelphia police officer. Since 1981, Mumia has maintained his innocence. His story has not changed. Mumia was shot, brutalized, arrested, and chained to a hospital bed. The first police officer assigned to him wrote in a report that the Negro male made no comment, as cited in Philly Mag. Yet 64 days into the investigation, another officer testified that Mumia had confessed to the killing. Mumia's story has not changed. But we are talking about the same Philadelphia Police Department whose behavior shocks the conscience, according to a 1979 DOJ report. Behaviors like shooting nonviolent suspects, abusing handcuffed prisoners, and tampering with evidence. It should therefore come as little surprise that according to Dr. Johanna Fernandez, over one-third of the 35 officers involved in Mumia's case were subsequently convicted of rank corruption, extortion, and tampering with evidence to obtain convictions in unrelated cases. This is the same Philadelphia Police Department where officers ran racial profiling sweeps like Operation Cold Turkey in March 1985, targeting black and brown folks, and bombed the Move House in May of that year, killing 11 people, including 5 children, and destroying 61 homes. The same Philadelphia Police Department whose officers 8 days before the 2020 presidential election shot Walter Wallace Jr. dead in the streets in front of his crying mother. The Philadelphia Fraternal Order of Police has unrelentingly campaigned for Mumia's execution. During their August 1999 national meeting, a spokesperson for the organization stated that they will not rest until Abu Jamal burns in hell. The former Philadelphia president of the Fraternal Order of Police, Richard Costello, went as far as to say that if you disagree with their views of Mumia, you can join him in the electric chair and that they will make it an electric couch. The trial judge on Mumia's case in 1981, Albert Sabo, was a former member of the Fraternal Order of Police. Court reporter Terry Moore Carter overheard Judge Sabo telling a colleague, "I'm going to help them fry the nigger." Found in December 2018 in an inaccessible storage room of the DA's office, 6 boxes of documents from Mumia's case reveal previously undisclosed and highly significant evidence showing that Mumia's trial was tainted by a failure to disclose material evidence in violation of the United States and Pennsylvania constitutions. In November 2019, the Fraternal Order of Police filed a King's Bench petition asking the court to allow the state attorney general, not the Philadelphia DA's office, to handle the upcoming appeals. As the FOP president John McNesby said just last year, Mumia should remain in prison for the rest of his life. And a King's Bench order provides the legal angle for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to uphold Judge Sabo's original wish, which was for Mumia ultimately to die in prison. Today we are living through a moment where it's acceptable to paint "End Racism Now" in front of the Philadelphia Police Department's 26th District headquarters. And yet a political prisoner who has since the age of 14 dedicated his life to fighting against racism, continues to be caged and lives his life on a slow death row. We're in the midst of a movement that says Black Lives Matter, and if that's truly the case, then it means that Mumia's life and legacy must matter, and the causes that he sacrificed his life and freedom for must matter as well. Through all of the torture Mumia has suffered over the past 38 years, his principles have never wavered. These principles have manifested themselves in his writing countless books while incarcerated, in his successful radio show, in the time and energy he has poured into his mentorship of younger incarcerated folks, and the continued concern with the people suffering outside of the walls. Even while living in the hells of the prison system, Mumia still fights for our human rights. We must continue to fight for him and his human rights. Mumia is 66 years old. He is a grandfather. He is an elder with ailments. He is a human being that deserves to be free. Free Mumia.
That was Colin Kaepernick, NFL quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, until he was ostracized for his political protests against police brutality.
Mumia Abu-Jamal's weekly radio commentaries were a staple feature here on Sonali Kalhotker's Uprising program, which he was when he was still producing them. I hope we'll have his voice and his wisdom with us for some time to come. Incidentally, years ago when I helped bring Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman to Columbus to speak at a conference at Ohio State University, I got Mumia to write her an introductory letter. He sent it personally, signed and all, and as I introduced Amy, I read the letter anonymously, not revealing the author's identity till the very end. She was deeply appreciative as I gave her the letter. This has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis. I'll see you here again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
You're listening to WGRN 94.1, Columbus Community Radio, the Green Renaissance.
Looks like a mess. How long the moment might last is anyone's guess. For all of the bold propaganda, what kind of system is best? The moments like this one are the test. Where did they stay ahead of the curve? Where did they just run out of soap? Once the world shut down its borders, which countries were able to cope? Once this pandemic is over, this could be a teachable moment, the moment we find out how much it can be so hard to get through just a day when you can't touch someone that you know, to hold their hands in yours. How interminable the walls, the ceilings, floors. How long a day goes on. How lonely life can be. How much we're all a part of a society. Once this pandemic is over, this could be a teachable moment where anyone with half a brain understands that we're all just as good as the weakest link in the chain. With exponential growth, one for all and all for one is the only way to hope to slow such a viral run. With some of us in mansions and others left in tents, while what's drifting in the air won't be kept out by a fence. Once the pandemic is over, this could be a teachable moment, though at the price of so many lives lost, to be stratified and divided death is the cost. After all of the funerals, after we've mourned all the dead, might we then have a world that's bound by a common thread? A thread that is sown like a virus and connects us all worldwide. Maybe then we can say there's a reason your grandparents died. Once this pandemic is over,